Okay. Oh, now I introduce myself. Hi, I'm Teresa. I'm an alcoholic. I'm your 10-minute speaker. So, it's good to be here. It's good to be sober. Thank you, Lee, for letting me tag along. Lee's the main speaker. I'm 10 minutes. That's why I'm here. Got hoodwinked into it. But what a lovely group of people. Thank you so much for breakfast, and thank you for putting Lee and I up last night. And we had a lovely dinner. Thank you, everybody. I'd name names, but I'll leave somebody out. I know Cheryl, and Sharon were there. Okay, and Brett and Bill and Marcy, those are who's the other one? See, I didn't want to name names. But anyway, thank you so much. What?
Carl.
Oh, Carl was. Carl was there. Yes. And I think one other person was there and left early. But anyway, it's really good to be here. It's good to be sober. I love the heat. It's always kind of chilly. I live in Santa Barbara now. It's always kind of chilly and overcast. And you know, we have maybe one good week or two of nice 80 to 90 degree weather. So I like it here. I like the heat. Maybe we should move. No. But yeah, I live in Santa Barbara. I can't even believe sometimes that I live there. I know I was just talking to the ladies at this table earlier, and I said, yeah, I'll be driving down the street, and I go, wow, I live here. You know, and what's good about being sober is I recognize what I have. You know, when I was drinking, it was always like, oh, poor me, my life sucks. But and though I can still get into that, oddly enough, I can still think that. Sober, with all the gifts I have in my life and all the blessings that I have in my life, I can still get on the pity pot. And but then on the other hand, I'll be just standing in my kitchen on a random morning, random day, just standing in my kitchen and think, I just get overwhelmed with gratitude for no apparent reason. And I just like want to fall on my knees and just say, thank you, God, for my many blessings and for the life I have today. The life I have today is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I used to drink and use, and I know now why I drank. I didn't know. I was the last to know that I was an alcoholic, although the court had been telling me I was an alcoholic. You know, the judge, my mother was telling me I was an alcoholic. Even some friends were saying, hey, what's up? And I just, you know, the thought of not drinking wasn't really an option for me because what alcohol did for me, I really couldn't see what it was doing to me. And what it did for me, it was it relieved the fear, it relieved the anxiety, which consumed me. It consumed me, I believe. I mean, my first thoughts as it, going to kindergarten, and I'm like, oh my God, all those people are here, and I don't like people. And all those little kids were there, and I just hated to go every day. I remember thinking when I was 5 years old that I wish I was one of my dogs. I wish I was a lamp. Imagine, 5 years old, I wish I was that lamp over there so I wouldn't have to go to school with all those little people. And so when I started drinking at 13, oh my God, what a relief, right? What a relief. And my first thought was, wow, this is great. My next thought was, no wonder Dad drinks, because my father was a daily drinker. And, you know, it was fun growing up, fun. I grew up on the East Coast. It was just super fun. But, you know, alcohol was always involved. And so that was another reason, I guess, I drank, because it was just the thing to do. Everybody did it, no matter what it was, you know. How I ended up getting sober, I'll tell you, my last night of drinking, my last night of drinking, I'd moved to California, moved to L.A. from Massachusetts. And I moved, you know, there's a couple of reasons, I think, why I moved. Nothing really positive. I have really no concrete reason why, but I just always wanted to go there. One of the reasons was I was like, you know, 20-ish, 21 when I moved. Well, I know I was 21 because I was a drinking age in California. It was 18 on the East Coast at the time. They soon realized their mistake and turned it back to 21. And so I wanted to go find Haight-Ashbury, do the Haight-Ashbury scene up in San Francisco. But I missed it by about 10 years. And to this day, I have not been to Haight-Ashbury. I've never been to that district. I've been in California over 30 years now. Never been there. But anyway, that was my motivation. And but, you know, L.A. was great. Hollywood, lived in Hollywood at first. That was great. Everything I thought it would be, you know, wild and crazy. And so I got arrested a bunch of times for DUIs, drugs. Well, not a bunch, only six. And you know, it's kind of like, oh, so my mother moved to California to kind of take care of me because things were really going downhill, and it's a really long story and don't have time. But, okay, so the last night of my drinking, I finally totaled my car. I'm living in El Segundo by LAX with my mother. We got a condo after she moved out here. Got a condo together, which is good because I probably would have been homeless if I wasn't living with my mother. And so totaled my car. So I would go to the bars in Venice. I hung around Venice a lot. And bars were closing, and I would call my mother for a ride home. So she would drive all the way from El Segundo to Venice, which was, you know, half an hour, maybe 20 minutes, depending. Well, at 2:30, there's not much traffic, I guess. But so on her way, she comes, and by the time she got there, I met a new friend, and I said, thanks for coming. I'm going to go home with him. And she's like, what? No, get in the car. And I go, no, okay. Oh, so anyway, I snuck out the side door, and I'm just kind of going, walking down the boardwalk in Venice with my new friend. And my mother figured out what I was doing. She came after me. She's like, Teresa. I'm like, oh, I got to go with her. So anyway, went with my mother, got in the car, and we're driving home, and I'm loaded, right? I'm so drunk. So I'm an alcoholic. And once I stop drinking, I can't stop. So apparently I'm in a brownout now, blackout. I was a blackout drinker. And so my mother relayed this story to me on my one-year birthday. My family was not good at communicating, so no mention of this evening transpired between my mother and I for the whole year until she told me the story on my one-year birthday when she took me out to dinner. So anyway, this is how the story goes. We're on our way home, and we're on Lincoln Boulevard in Marina Del Rey, and there's this bar over here that sometimes let me in after hours. So I'm like, thanks for coming, Ma, but I'm going to get out here and go see if they'll let me in. She's like, what? Where? It's, you know, 2:30 in the morning. And so I start to get out of the car with my bottle of beer, and she's grabbing me, and we're fighting in the front seat, and she's, you know, and I'm holding, she's grabbing my pocketbook, and the strap broke on my pocketbook. We were struggling so much in the front seat of the car. So anyway, I go, phew, and I was able to escape. So I'm just walking down the street. She threw the car in park in the middle of the street. We stopped at a red light. She threw the car in park. I thought I was working on my ass. Car in park. So she came after me, and she took the bottle of beer out of my hands, and she smashed it in the street. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's my last beer. And I was ready to fight her, and she was going to fist fight. We were going to fist fight in the middle of the street. Cars are now going by honking their horns and stuff. And I don't know, call it my surrender, my moment of clarity, my spiritual awakening, although I didn't know it at the time. And I just went, oh, my God, what am I doing? This is my mother. I'm about to fist fight with her in the middle of the street. And I just started crying. I threw up my hands. I said, okay, let's go. And we got in the car and drove home. And I called this one person I'd known and that I used to smoke coke with. He didn't drink. He just did cocaine. But anyway, my coke connection, I called, and he had 9 months sober. And I remember when he got sober, I'm like, why? What? You're going to AA? Why? You don't even drink. What? You know, it was baffling and confusing to me. So I called him up. I said, you have to come get me. My mother's driving me crazy. So we did, and that was, by now it's 3 in the morning. He came and picked me up. I went over to his house, and the next day was a Saturday. And it was March 5th, 1983, and that was my first meeting of AA, not on a court card. And that's my sobriety date. I've been sober ever since that meeting that he took me to. And, I just like, he said, well, I'm going to a meeting tonight. Do you want to go? I'm like, I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll go. And, you know, I didn't have a car, and I didn't have nothing, didn't have anything going on. So, and I walked into this meeting. It was at, I'll never forget, it was on the Federal, on Wilshire Boulevard in L.A. and Westwood at the Federal Building. And there must have been 450 people there. And I'm like, oh, my God. People. I don't like people. And I'm straight. I'm not loaded. You know, I'm not drunk. I'm not high. I'm like, oh, my God. So talk about anxiety, Peggy. So I just, you know, they asked for newcomers. Of course, I didn't raise my hand because I was just visiting and I was with him, you know. So anyway, but everybody asked me if I was new. I don't know how they knew with all these people. How could they tell I was new? So I'm like, nope, not new. I'm not an alcoholic. So anyway, this woman, for some reason, said, well, come with me. And she brought me up to the literature table, and she showed me the big book, and I'm like, whatever. And she gave me the 20 questions. And she told me a little bit about how she used to drink. She worked in a law firm, and so did I. And I thought, oh, cool. And, then, you know, she used to shoot heroin on her breaks. I'm like, wow, that's awesome. I never did that. So I later asked her to be my sponsor because I was impressed with that. So she became my first sponsor. And so when I saw the 20 questions, I don't know if you've ever seen them, but it asks you questions like, do you drink alone? Do you have blackouts? Are you in financial difficulty? Yes, because I'm working on 2 DUIs at the moment. I'm in a lot of debt financially. And this was the early 80s, so fortunately I never really did any jail time. I was just overnight in the drunk tank. So if that were today, I'd be doing some time, I guess. But so I look at these 20 questions, and I remember sitting on my friend's couch. My mother was there. And I'm like, yes, 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 to like 17 of them, if I'm honest. There was about 17 yeses out of the 20. And I remember being excited. I go, Mom, look, maybe I'm an alcoholic. She's like, she'd been telling me for years I was an alcoholic. And she was so kind and loving. You know, she didn't go, Teresa, I've been telling you. You know, she didn't say that. She just looked at me and went, yes, honey, maybe you are. It's just so sweet. And so I felt excited, though, because I thought, you know, when I was out there drinking and stuff, like, what is wrong with me? I was so unhappy. I was so depressed all the time. My bills were paid, and, you know, of course, I'm living with my mother, so the rent was paid. And I just couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, and I was so unhappy. And I remember Alan asking me, he goes, are you happy? And I thought, I didn't know how to answer that, because I'm not in touch with my feelings or anything, you know what I mean? I just drink, that's all I do. And when he said, are you happy? I said, I didn't know how to answer. I said, I guess so. But honestly, I wasn't, and I just remember feeling relief from that. So anyway, the sponsor, she just had me getting in the program. I had to go to 6 or 7 meetings a week. I had to get 3 commitments. I had to call her every day. I couldn't get up and walk around during the meeting. I couldn't get, you know, couldn't go get coffee. Couldn't go to the bathroom. You just sit when the meeting's on. You sit down, you know, that kind of stuff. And, oh, gosh, it's like 10 minutes already, huh? So anyway, you know, I'll just wrap it up and just say I've been sober a long time, and I have this little book study that I go to every Wednesday at a women's recovery home. And, you know, I just love reading books. The book is just chock full of such valuable information. It just saves my life. And, you know, the stuff in there is amazing. If you knew, I encourage you to read that. Get in a book study. It's, you know, a lot better way to go than just reading it on your own, of course. So anyway, I try to figure out, okay, what's the most important thing in my sobriety? What's the one key thing that keeps me sober? Is it the steps? Is it the meetings? Is it the fellowship, like a group like this? You know, is it commitments? And obviously, I've come to the realization that it's all of it. It's a program. It's not the steps. It's not the meetings. It's not just having a sponsor. But it's everything. It's the whole program. And thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you keep coming back. Thanks. Okay. Speaker this morning, who is Lee from Santa Maria.
Thanks. My name's Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And first of all, great group, man. I mean, one of the best parts about coming here is you guys are absolutely amazing. Really, truthfully, I love the banter, the kick, the crosstalk that you got going with each other. I mean, Bill couldn't even get up here and read without giving him a break. But I tell you, if you like chocolate, don't sit with Brent, because you won't get any. I noticed there had been chocolate at the table, but not when I got there. I want to thank Bill for the invitation. I appreciate being here. I've been here a few times, and I really appreciate coming. It's a great area. And then Cheryl, right? Cheryl's over in the kitchen somewhere. I mean, we got to have someone like Cheryl everywhere we go, because the reason we need people, to me anyways, and we talked about it at dinner last night. Oh, I think the one that you forgot, dear, was Marcy. Marcy was there last night at dinner, but he left early. He left early. That's why we left him out, yeah. I know. Well, I got to pick. Everybody else is going to pick on you. I'm going to have that opportunity, too. Let them know. Yeah. And Jesse, when we walked in, it's amazing. That's part of it. You know, walked in, and Jesse's right at the door with a huge welcome. You know, and that is amazing when you're from out of town. You know, the number of y'all that came up and said hello. It's crazy, amazing how many times that does not happen, and why it's so special when you got a guy like Jesse and the rest of you that did say hello. It's huge. There have been times when I've been out of town doing this deal, and not one person said hello. You know, and the fruit from that, though, is that if you ever come to my home group, the men's stag, or any group that I'm really involved in Santa Maria, I guarantee you there will be 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 people walk up and say, "Hi, welcome. Are you new or are you visiting?" Because we've learned you can't assume just because someone's new that they could be visiting, etc. So anyways, that's the preliminaries. Also, I didn't get a chance to meet this gentleman here, but nice boots, man. I was going to say something at the break, but I couldn't find you. I'll tell you, last night when we got to the restaurant, we pulled up in the parking lot, and there were a couple of their cars pulled up at the same time, and there's some a little bit ahead of us, got out of their truck or vehicle, I don't remember what it was, and first thing one of the guys did is light up a cigarette, and I go, "Oh, that's our people," you know, and it was Carl. Carl took like 3 drags and then threw it out, you know, it's like, one of us, that's our people. And the thing is, though, other than Brent, who I know for years, Brent and I have been friends, you know, for a long time. I'm on his email list and get his deal every weekly. But I didn't know people, so when we walked up, Bill and I hadn't met before, and I was dressed like I am now with my hat on, and he just thought I was one of the locals. You know, he didn't realize I was the guy coming. And I don't know. I'll talk a little bit about that, I suppose. What other admin stuff? I don't know. I guess that's about it. I'll tell you right off the bat, my sobriety date is December 10th, 1987. I got sober in 1987. My home group is the Thursday Night Men's Stag, and my sponsor is a guy named Bob Darrell out of Las Vegas. And I say that for a few reasons. One, that's what I've been taught. Sponsorship is important to me. There's a difference between having a sponsor and being sponsored, and I am sponsored. I have a man who cares more about my sobriety than he does about my feelings, and that's important. That's important. And that's, where is Cheryl Cook? Is still in the back? That's, in my neck of the woods, for me, it was a lady named Gail. Gail was my Cheryl. I don't know, and I know from dinner last night that she's like that with a lot of us. But, you know, Gail could say to me things that I would hear and not take offense that Brent couldn't or Marcy couldn't, you know? Because if they said it, I'd get angry, you know? And so I needed people like that in my life. It was important to me, and so I have a sponsor. I'm proud of my sponsor. My home group, the men's stag, the Thursday night meeting in Santa Maria. Great meeting. Best meeting in the world for me. You know, and if I lived out here in Springville or Porterville, I'm sure there's one here that would be my meeting. But that's my meeting. We have a timer. You know, I can listen to anybody whine for 3 minutes. You know, no problem. 3 minutes timer. You ever been to New York? Wasn't my idea, really. I mean, I got tired of people whining and complaining, just going on and on and on and on and on about nothing. Then I went to New York. And in every meeting I went to in New York, whether it was the Bronx or Manhattan, every meeting I went to, they had a timer. Every one of them. And I thought, wow, that's a great idea. I took it back to the meeting, to the group, and said, "Hey, let's take a group conscience and put in a timer." And the group conscience was to have a timer. And so now in Santa Maria, there's a whole bunch of meetings that have timers because it kind of caught on. It's nice having a timer. And in the men's stag, we say, out of respect for this church as well as other members present, we ask that profanity be avoided when possible. And it's amazing. It's amazing how we can clean up, you know, if we really put our mind to it. You know, we don't say it's, you know. Anyways, that's my home group. And my sobriety date, December 10, 1987. I'm very proud of that date. You know, I woke up that morning, went to the front room and pulled out a fifth of whiskey that I had opened the night before. And there was like a finger's width left in the bottom of it, you know. I don't know why I didn't finish it, but there was a finger's width left in the bottom of it. And I looked at the woman I was married to at that time, and I said, "How much of this did you drink?" Yeah. And she said, "None of it." And I said, "Damn it. I did it again." I had not intended to drink a fifth of whiskey all by myself again. You know, I had just taken my last final at Cal Poly. I was going to Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo College. And I had taken my last final. I came home and I was going to get a buzz, man. I just feel good. And I drank a fifth. And I made a few phone calls and found out about this AA thing. And I went to the new book study at the Pioneer Group in San Luis Obispo. No idea who was there except for one person, Jack L. And no idea what was read. But the reason I knew Jack was there is because after the meeting, he came up to me, like, I bet you do here, or wherever y'all are from. There's some Hanford table, I understand, and there's Bakersfield, Rick and Margo and Karen, and Santa Barbara. I say it right? Santa Barbara, right? And I forgot, yeah, have a Teresa. Teresa and I have been traveling together a lot. It's funny, Hav and I have never dated anybody that had more time than me. It's a difference. You know, it's different, you know. We were at a conference last week in Torrance. I was the baby at the table with 31 years. I was like, wow, it was weird, you know, but... Anyways, Jack came up to meeting after the meeting, put his hand out, and said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And he had a big book. It was a third edition, but it was like this one, hardbound. And he tried to give it to me, and I wouldn't take it. And he's like, "No, this is our program. You know, you need to read this book." Kind of like what someone said earlier. Teresa said, what Teresa was talking about, reading the book. And I wouldn't take it. And then finally I did, and I don't know what the difference was, but the reason I wouldn't take it, why I was so hesitant to take it at that moment from him, was that I was going to Cal Poly. I was going to college. I was paying $60-$70 for books like this. I know they're a lot more now, but back then it was $60-$70 for a hard-bound book. And I figured that's what AA was going to charge, $60-$70, right? I mean, that's... And at school, you could sell it back at the end of the quarter, you know? And I didn't think AA would buy it back. But I tell you what, Jack, he told me the deal, and I took it. And if any of the newcomers were, we had Brad, Chad and Amanda, and Philip. Wasn't one at the table over here? Whatever, the other guy. You know, if you guys need a book, I got them in my truck. Just like Jack taught me 31 years ago, I carry books with me and give them out. Just like he taught me 31 years ago. So if you need a big book, I'll give you one for free. And he said something about a sponsor, so I said, well, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah. And so at the end of my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a big book and I had a sponsor. How many of you can say that? Every now and then a hand will go up. But unfortunately, I didn't read that book or call that sponsor for 5.5 years. You know, now how many people, right? Yeah, right. For 5.5 years, I was what I refer back to as stark raving sober. Stark raving sober. I came here to not drink, and I was not drinking just fine. Thank you very much. You know, and if I got called on in a meeting, I'd share, if you don't drink and you don't use, no matter how you do it, you're not wrong. And you know what would happen? If they wouldn't call on me again, that's what would happen. And I'd punish that meeting and quit going to it. If they're not going to call on me, I'm not going to go. And within a relatively short period of time, I wasn't going to many meetings because I was punishing them all. Yeah. And stark raving sober. The woman I was married to at that time came across some poetry I'd written. Pretty dark poetry. And within a couple of days, I was checked into the psych ward at French Hospital in San Luis Obispo. And it's important, and the reason I bring it up, it's important for a couple of reasons. One, it was a miracle. Really, it really was a miracle. It was HMO time back in the day. We had HMOs. I think they still have them today. They're not as popular as they used to be. But with an HMO, you needed a referral from your primary doctor to a secondary doctor, which went to a board. And if it was an emergency, like in a week, you get checked into the hospital. I mean, they were inefficient to the nth degree. Within a couple of days, I was checked into that psych ward. And I took with me a big book, and I took a 12 and 12, and they had paper and pen in the psych ward, and I did my first inventory while I was in that psych ward. And it's important for a few reasons. One, in order to do a second inventory, you have to have taken a first inventory. And in order to do a third inventory, you have to have taken a second. To be taking continuous inventory, you got to be doing something. That first inventory is a joke. It's a joke how bad it is. It's hilarious. I still have it. Because I looked at page 65, and there's three columns on page 65. And so I looked at, you know, remember, I'm not listening at meetings that I'm going to. I'm not calling my sponsor and asking them, how do you do an inventory? I'm an accountant by trade. I know what inventories are. Thank you very much. You know, I know, and there it is, page 65. So that's what I did. Page 65. There, boom, boom, boom. That's my first inventory. I didn't turn the page. And page 67, where it says, setting aside the wrongs that had done, we resolutely looked at our own mistakes. I didn't do that. I just did page 65, those three columns. So technically, is it an inventory? I'll tell you what, it got me through to number 2, 3, 4. And what I say now, and it's the truth, absolutely, I'm 31 years sober. I've done more inventories in the last 5 years in the first 26 combined. Absolutely no question about it. I'm not exaggerating, not overemphasizing. It's the magic elixir for me, is getting those inventories done and figuring out what's my part in it, what were my mistakes, and how do I behave better so that I don't do it again. But that was my first one in the psych ward. And the other reason it's important is because, as I mentioned, I still have it. I didn't write anything I did in there. There's nothing incriminating. So I didn't need to burn it, tear it up, destroy it. And I'll pull it out every now and again when I'm working with guys like me that are work at the speed of pain, you know, that just don't do it until it hurts too much, and like I did. And I'll pull it out, and it's written on, you know, San Luis Obispo French Hospital Psychiatric Ward letterhead, right? They see that, they start writing quick, you know. It's, you know, over in NA, they talk about jails, institutions, or death. And for me, it was an institution. I got out of that psych ward and got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Can't tell you what happened or why it happened, other than people nominated me. I went to the men's stag, the Tuesday night men's stag, and someone said, the secretary gave it up, Bubba. His name was Bubba. Bubba decided he was no longer, after he gave up the meeting, he decided he was no longer an alcoholic, and he's been drinking ever since. But that day he gave up the meeting, and someone said, I'd nominate Lee. I hadn't been to that meeting before. I couldn't even remember having been to that meeting, but they said, I'd nominate Lee. And I thought, the guys aren't going to vote me in. They don't even know me. They voted me in. So I got that. Someone else nominated me to be the secretary or the grapevine representative for the district, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I just got involved in the service. And back then, I would tell you everything I was doing. I want to make sure you knew what I'm doing. Wrong reasons. I wanted the credit. I absolutely did, you know. But now, the things I understand what Chuck Chamberlain meant when he said, we do this stuff for fun and for free. You know, we do this stuff for fun and for free. And the rewards we get are amazing. You know, the person I have become, I'm blown away sometimes. I'm so happy and proud to be the man I've become because of you, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the steps, because of the God of my understanding. Got out of that psych ward and got involved in service and became a whole new person. But I always talk about, but from whence did I come? I used to not want to talk about what it was like. Everybody drank. You know, we all had our stories. And Cliff Roach was my sponsor for a long, long time. In fact, Brent and I were talking about Cliff a lot. He has a lot. It's 95 degrees out. I'm wearing a coat because Cliff Roach told me you always wear a coat when you get up to the podium. And I always have. And, you know, I can take it off, but I wear it up. But Cliff had a lot to do. And heck, I guess some people, it was a lot of white hair, so a lot of y'all remember Cliff. But some places you go and people don't remember Cliff anymore. And he was the guy. He was the speaker for a long, long, long time. Oceanside, where's that? Right? But now I forgot where I was going. Got off on Cliff. Psych ward. Got out of the psych ward service. Anybody help me? Anybody remember? Let me think. What? What it was like growing up. But still, I was at a spot. Anyways, getting psych ward. Single mom on welfare, San Diego. That's where I'll go back. I'll go to that. I grew up on San Diego, single mom on welfare. And I remember peace marches, anti-Vietnam marches. There was some guy named Nixon running against some guy named McGovern. My mom hated Nixon. My mom, big time, she was taking me to those peace marches. She was doing all those things. My dad, it turns out, I didn't know until I met him when I was 25 years old. My dad was over in Vietnam getting his ass shot off. And I asked him, I said to him, you know, where were you, man? And he said, I was over in Vietnam getting shot at, and you and your mom were back here in peace marches. Two people like that can't live together. And I knew exactly what he meant. I knew exactly what he meant. Because when I turned 18, I asked my mom, how are you voting on Measure A? And she said, I'm voting yes because, wah, wah, wah. I didn't hear another word. I'm voting no. Whatever it was, I didn't care. She's voting yes, I'm voting no. You know, my mom, you know, her political spectrum, my mom is so far left, she's a danger to oncoming traffic, man. I mean, she's just over there, you know. Now, I'm not saying I'm not even getting into politics, but it's just, that's what I grew up with. And, had no dad because he bailed whatever time. My heroes were those guys up on the silver screen, man. John Wayne and Clint Eastwood. Those were the guys. That's who I want to be like. They're my role models, man. You know, The Outlaw of Josie Wales, one of the best movies of all time. And people nowadays, yeah, see there's claps out here. But people nowadays, seriously, I talk about The Outlaw of Josie Wales and people got to Google it. I was like, oh, it's getting sad. But The Outlaw, I'm telling you, 1 hour and 20, you know how some people know the Rocky Horror Picture Show? You ever go to the Rocky Horror Picture Show and you can't hear the audio because so many people. I know Outlaw Josie Wales like some people know the Rocky Horror Picture Show. He's my hero, man. 1 hour and 28 minutes into that movie, Josie Wales rides into this ghost town, a quasi ghost town. There's a few people in the bar, and he goes into the bar and there's some banter back and forth. And they ask him, they say, "What'll it be, partner?" And Josie Wales says, "Whiskey." And they say, "You know, we've been dried up in this town for years. There's a little bit more banter." And Josie Wales leaves. And then in that Hollywood fashion, you hear his spurs clinking as he's getting closer and closer. He kicks open those bat wing doors, and he's got a case of whiskey in one hand and two bottles of whiskey in the other hand, and he's the man. They love him. He gets the girl, kills all the bad guys. His former enemy respects him in the end of the movie, man. And I want to be just like Josie Wales. That's what I want to be just like. Unfortunately, in the real world, what you get is a suspended sentence for assault and battery. And a girl doesn't want that to do with you, man. I mean, she just doesn't. It's just that. That's not what happens. It's up there on the screen. And, you know, John Wayne, man, my hero, man. If you could picture John Wayne walking into a bar room and or a saloon and walking over to the bartender and saying, you know, pass the crack pipe, pilgrim. You'd have a different smoke. You'd have a different speaker, you know, because I'd have been smoking crack. But John Wayne did not ask for a crack pipe. John Wayne asked for whiskey, you know, and that's what I drank. I don't remember my first drink. You know, I absolutely don't. I prayed and prayed and meditated and God, tell me, please. I don't know. I can't remember. What I do know, I joined the military at 17 and a half, 18. And when I came home on my first leave, it was Thanksgiving. We went to the same place we've been for years, my mom and I, some friends of my mom's who were of the same political persuasion as her. And they weren't big on the military. My mom wasn't real big on the military when I was doing the military. And long story short, they were teasing me about my uniform, and I was proud about my uniform. I was proud of who I was and what I had done, and even if it was just boot camp thus far. But they were teasing me, and then they said something that got to me, and they said, you know, you look sharp in that uniform today, but you remember that time you were 5 years old, we gave you that hit of acid? You were tripping that day, man. I know, and I was like, what? What? You guys gave me acid when I was 5 years old? Oh, I was angry and pissed off about that for years. Years. You know when I finally got free of it? When I did the inventory on my mom. My sponsor said it was my fifth inventory. Fifth. And my sponsor said, do an inventory only on your mom. And I said, my mom, but every inventory I've done. And he said, I don't care. Just do one on your mom. Nobody else can be on this inventory. So I did. And I got free of it. And also there's another, some of y'all know this, a speaker named Bob Earl. Bob Earl was my hero for a long, long time. Now I couldn't listen to his talk because of his language, but back in the day when I was new and, you know, he was my hero. And Bob said something, and my sponsor helped with it, and Bob said, and what I believe now is my mom did the best she could with the tools she had. Thank you, Mom, I love you. Period. There is no but coming. No, but. I used to say, but not anymore. My mom did the best she could with the tools she had. Thank you, Mom. I love you. If I hadn't gone through what I came through, I wouldn't be who I am today. And I'm proud and happy of the man I am today, you know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It's funny, my mom, recently I was talking to her and she was, jumping to a different topic. I was on the front page as a veteran. Today it's another friend of mine, but they're doing hometown heroes. Honor stories, and so on the front page of the local newspaper in Santa Maria, they're doing every Sunday big stories on veterans, and I was one of them, the first one, and it caught me completely off guard. He said he was interviewing 40 people, and he didn't know who was going to make it and who wasn't, and I'm like, whatever, I'm here if you need me, and it made the cut, got on the paper, sent it to my mom, and she was very proud, and when she got on the phone, she said, you know, talking about me and all the things I do and how much of service I am and how giving I am to the community and all this stuff. And she said, She said, I really did a good job, didn't I? Now, before doing the work, I would have said, Mom, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you kidding me? And it would have been a fight and I would have hurt her feet. Instead, I said, yeah, Mom, you did, you know, and let it go, you know. So, you know, so that fifth inventory, I did the inventory work on Mom and got free of it. But, you know, some friends of hers gave me acid when I was 5 years old. Now that's part of my story. I was eating acid at five. All right. Now, you know, not unique. So it's happened to others, you know, happened to others. I was talking in L.A. one time and there was a young 10-minute speaker and she had talked about smoking pot when she was five with her parents, you know. And it's like nothing unique about it. It's just part of my story. You know, I was eating acid at five. I remember stealing 6 packs of beer out of the back of a thrifty drugstore in sixth grade. You know, that's 11, 12 years old. You know, we used to steal Schlitz malt liquor. Remember that stuff? But yeah. You know, I swear to God, I hadn't known. I used to share. I don't even know if they make that stuff anymore. And there was a newcomer, nodded his head. Yeah, they do. Schlitz Malt Liquor and Southern Comfort, right? You remember Southern Comfort? Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Southern Comfort at AA meeting, people start drooling. It's like an aphrodisiac, you know? You know, my first wife was an Al-Anon, not an alcoholic, and she had heard me talk about this Southern Comfort all over and over and over again. She never tried Southern Comfort. And one day we were coming back from L.A., and we pulled into this gas station to get gas, and I went to go pay or whatever it was, went into the store, and they had those little airport bottles. And they had, right in the front was an airport bottle of Southern Comfort. So I bought it for her, and I took it out. I go, look, here's Southern Comfort. Why don't you try it? She took one sip and threw it away. I'm like, God, are you kidding me? God. And that's not why I divorced her, but, you know, whatever. Crazy. So the inventory work and doing the image change and getting a single mom and all that stuff, and I was going, God, I'm sorry, I'm losing my spot again. Going off on this, Brent and I were talking about it too. I was saying that the best speakers are always salesmen and lawyers, or salespeople and lawyers, because we can go off on the threads and bring it back to where you came from. And I keep forgetting up here today. I'm just comfortable, I guess. But I was talking, steal 6 packs of beer, then switch malt liquor and Southern Comfort. And then when I matured at about the age of 14 is when I found whiskey. And then, you know, from then on, if I'm buying them, I'm buying Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, Old Crow. I don't care. If I have a choice in the matter, it's going to be whiskey. Now, of course, I'll drink whatever you got, but I'm buying the whiskey. And why? Why would I drink whiskey? Because that's what John Wayne drank. You know, that's what Clint Eastwood drank, man. Real men drink whiskey, you know. And then at some point along the line, I went into the military. And I went into a thing called Special Forces, you know, the Green Berets. You know, why would I be a Green Beret? Because John Wayne was a Green Beret, you know. John Wayne was a Green Beret, I was a Green Beret. If John Wayne would have been a Navy SEAL, I'd have joined the Navy, you know. But he was a Green Beret, so I was a Green Beret. After I talked about this one time in the thank you line, there was a gentleman in the generation above mine, and he came up to me and he said, you know, John Wayne was a Marine before he was a Green Beret. I was like, man, I didn't see that movie, man. I saw a Green Beret. That's the truth. Absolute truth. And, you know, back then the slogan was, it's a great place to start. And it was. That's how I got money to go to college, was through the military. And, you know, I got promoted quickly. I don't know what it is now, but back in my day, you know, it was, you know, I got promoted to E6, and the day that I was eligible to become an E6, I got promoted to E6. I did well. I like structure. You know, I like structure. I do well in structure. And so I did good. But I had a big brother of America. You know, I didn't have a dad, so my mom enrolled me in that program where I had a big brother. And that man was very influential in my life. And I called him from Panama. I was in Central America. And I said, hey, I just got promoted. Woohoo, you know. And I thought he was going to say, right on, good job. And what he said was, why did you join the military? And I said, to get money to go to college. And he said, and do you have that? And I said, well, yeah. Because back then it was a program where there's a certain amount you could get. And it's maxed out. And I had maxed out already. And he said, well, mission accomplished. And so I got it. And then so I waited a little bit longer and left in Panama, Central America, and I went to school. But, you know, it was a great place to start, and the military was for me. And got out of, you know, and also from the military, I got turned on to a thing called country music, right? I grew up on the beach, man, you know, rock and roll, you know, country music. You know, who the hell listens to country music? Don't raise your hand. I was in Bakersfield with Rick and Margo one time. I said, who listens to country music? Everybody raised their hand. You know, no, it was a rhetorical question, you know. It was like, I thought Hicks listened to country music, man. That's what I mean, I'm into rock, not the Beatles. You know, if you're a Beatles freak, you know, amen, namaste, whatever. I mean, no. You know, Let It Be, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Lovely Rita Meter Maid. Are you kidding me, man? I like Rolling Stones, you know, songs like Bitch, you know, or Rip This Joint, right? Or If You Can't Rock Me, Somebody Will, or Tom Petty, You Don't Know How It Feels to Be Me, you know, or Aqualung, you know, Jethro Tull, right? Snot running down his nose. I mean, that's some lyrics, right? Come on. But country music, I got turned on, you know, and I'm still a country music fan now to this day. But specifically a couple. Hank Williams Jr., everybody knows Hank Jr. because of his dad. Hank's, you know, he was on Monday Night Football for a long time. But also I got turned on to another guy named David Allen Coe. Okay, there's a lot of people. Okay. I was talking in Oklahoma once. I almost got a standing ovation when I went. I swear to God, they went wild when I mentioned David Allen Coe. Now, if you haven't heard of David Allen Coe, or even if you have and you know about some of his songs, I'm not talking about those songs. Yeah, these guys get that. I'm not. I'm talking about his more mainstream songs. And in analysis, and it was actually in inventory work where I figured out, why do I like David Allen Coe so much? Why do I like David Allen Coe so much? Is because he... It, it, what he sings about. Pain, heartache, and betrayal. If you trust someone, you're going to get hurt. Therefore, don't trust anyone. Oh, can I relate to that? And I'm not unique. Don't get me wrong. I'm not unique. But, I've been hurt. And so when he's talking about love is a never-ending war, you know, or I hate love. One of the songs, I hate love more than anything else in life. I hate love. And man, you can drink whiskey and get wasted and go, yeah, me too, man. You know, it doesn't work with Simon and Garfunkel, but with David Allan Coe, that works, man. You know, it does. And it's, you know, changed a lot, you know, for me. Teresa and I have been, it's just amazing. You know, I swear I was on my knees, almost in tears, praying. And then Teresa and I developed, you know, and I think it was God, divine intervention, if you will. I won't go into the prayers I was saying, but this thing happened in life. And how I just love the God of my understanding now. And I hopefully I'll talk about God in a little bit. But, you know, it's, you know, that's what I got from the military, and is the David Allan Coe stuff and country music. Got out of the military and went to Cal Poly, 5.5 years, stark raving sober, which I told you about. And then on December 10th, 1987, woke up. For 5.5 years, I worked half a step. On December 10th, 1987, I admitted I'm powerless over alcohol. I cannot drink it. I can't. If I drink alcohol, I want more. If I drink alcohol, I will drink until I'm blacked out and passed out. There's not even anything else. That's it. Unless I run out or something, and there's no way to get any more. You know that. Why were I talking a few weeks ago? Oh, in San Diego. And there was a guy, the 10-minute speaker, had talked about his wife took away his car keys and everything, so he drove his tractor, or his lawnmower. He drove his lawnmower to go to the liquor store. You know, and that's it. That's what we do, right? That's what we do. I will drive, I will get there if I can. You know, I can't drink it. You know, there's a few for the newcomers that, you know, it took me a long time. I'll tell you a little secret to Alcoholics Anonymous, or about us anyways. And maybe there's some of you guys that are new, that are nearly new. But, you know, there's nothing shameful about being an alcoholic. There's nothing shameful about being an alcoholic. We do shameful things when we're drunk. Absolutely. No question about it. No doubt. So do non-alcoholics. You know, non-alcoholics do shameful things when they're drunk too. One time. Once they do it. And the next time they start drinking, they go, oh, I remember what happened last time. You know what, man? I'm going to stick to the water tonight. Or I'm going to have some apple juice. I'm good. And me, I'm like, hey, baby, it ain't going to happen tonight. It's going to be different. I promise. And it's never different. It's always the same thing. You know, and there are people that are allergic to peanut butter, you know. And so when we were kids, the people that are allergic to peanut butter, their moms told the host of the party, don't give my child any peanut butter or peanut butter cookies or anything because he's allergic to it. Same for penicillin. It used to be bracelets we wore. I don't know what it is nowadays, but used to wear bracelets that said, I'm allergic to penicillin. Don't give me penicillin. They're not ashamed that they're allergic to penicillin. If you give them penicillin, they will die. It will kill them. I'm allergic to alcohol. I'm not embarrassed or ashamed of that. I can't drink it. You know, I could go periods of time without drinking, no problem. It's just when I start, get out of the way because I'm going to drink, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to drink. But my life unmanageable, half a step for 5.5 years. My life unmanageable, no, man, I don't want to hear about it. I'm a former Green Beret. I'm going to Cal Poly. I had a wife and two kids at that time and 3.8 GPA, working for UPS in the morning, loading the trucks, going to school in the day. Life was pretty good. My life unmanageable, no, I don't want to hear about it. But while I think it's a human trait, I don't think it's an alcoholic trait that, you know, fitting a square peg into a round hole, you get a big enough hammer, you can fit it, you can make it fit. But there was really no way that I can reconcile that I am managing my life well with I'm in a psych ward. I mean, unless you really, really should be in the psych ward. You know, I mean, if you're that far gone on the extreme, you might be able to fit it. But if you're really, the psych ward was just a safe place for me. It wasn't that I was going crazy. And I couldn't say, yes, I'm managing my life well and I'm in the psych ward. I had to admit that my life was unmanageable by me. And I did. when I was in that psych ward. And then, but came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore my sanity. Well, first, before I even talk about that, I want to let you know, I know this is not a step workshop, and I'm not going to talk about all 12 steps. Whew, don't worry about it. I'm going to go up to maybe four in the amount of time I have. Because how they pertain to me. So came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Well, first of all, to be restored to sanity would mean that I am currently insane. And I'm not insane, thank you very much, so I don't need to be restored to sanity. I'm good, right? Because my idea of insanity was any early Jack Nicholson movie. You know, The Shining, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's what insanity looks like. I don't look like that. I'm not insane, thank you very much. Well, after the psych ward, I'm paying attention to meetings. I'm listening now. I'm paying attention to what you're sharing. And when people say things to me, I try to take it positively, not negatively. And a woman came up to me after a meeting and said to me, the last time I was here, I was a diehard Charger fan. I was a diehard San Diego Charger fan. I grew up in San Diego. Chargers were in my blood. But when they moved to L.A., I just can't. I mean, L.A. was the enemy my entire life. Every L.A. team was an enemy. And she forgot to mention she's a Patriots fan, which reminds me, it's a good thing that the Patriots are playing tonight, or Teresa wouldn't have made it up here. She was, sorry, hon, you have fun, but I'm watching the Patriots. She's that much into it. But anyway, after a meeting one time, a woman said to me, get a case of Coca-Cola on Sunday morning, and while you're watching the Charger game, drink it. I'm like, what? That's sick. I mean, that's sick. That's sick. Can you imagine drinking a case of Coca-Cola while you watch a football game? Right. It's crazy. But make it Coors. Or Budweiser. Or you new guys can call it, make it Corona. You know, That makes sense. Absolutely. I can drink a case of beer while I watch a football game. Well, she said, that's the same amount of liquid that's insane thinking. And I go, oh, okay, that's what they're talking about. All right, okay, I get it. I am insane. I need to be restored to sanity. Now we get to that step three. Made a decision, to turn my will and my care to God by my understanding. When I came here, I'm one of those ones that when you talk about God, my neck hairs bristled. I didn't want to hear about God. If you want a God in your life, fine. But I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to know about it. And I don't want a God in my life. And I used to say that my mom raised me to believe, and I've amended that because I really don't know. I've talked to her a little bit about it, but not all that much. But I don't know why I came in here that way. What I do say is I came in here with my neck hairs bristling. My first spiritual experience came in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when a newcomer. I used to share that the only reason I didn't get drunk those first 5.5 years is that I got lucky. Plain out lucky. I didn't do anything to deserve it. I got lucky. Why did I stay sober? Even if I was stark raving sober, tinder dry, and so many people go in and out or out and die, I got lucky. And after a meeting, I shared that one day, and a newcomer came up to me. His nickname was Catholic Brian because he was very religious. And he came up to me after the meeting and he said, you know what, Lee, you didn't get lucky. He said, you had a God in your life looking out for you and you didn't even believe in him. And I went, huh. Okay. And it hit. It hit. I can't stand up here and explain it to you if you've never had it happen. But if you have, you know what I'm talking about. And I hope if you haven't had it happen yet, you stick around long enough like I did that it does. So I found a God of my understanding. And then someone said, talked about getting on my knees and praying. Real men don't get on their knees, man. John Wayne. You can tell me one movie John Wayne got on his knees. Clint Eastwood was a preacher in Pale Rider, and he didn't get on his knees. Real men don't get on their knees, is how I thought. And then someone said something that made all the difference. And I'll share it. Half the room's heard it. But what someone said is, you know, put your shoes underneath your bed at night. And while you're down there, say a quick prayer. And I said, all right, I can do that. So I drew the shades, locked the door, and put my shoes underneath my bed at night. And I want to make it clear, I was on my knees to put my shoes underneath. I went on my knees to pray. It just happened that I was that way. And while I was there, I said a quick prayer and changed my life. Absolutely changed my life. That little bit of humility got to the point where now, and Teresa and I, are on our knees together many nights and many mornings, or sometimes she doesn't feel like getting out of bed yet, so I'll get on my knees and hold her hand, and she asks, does it count? I go, yeah, it still counts if you're laying in bed. You know? But I'm on my knees, you know. I'm on my knees praying to this day, every night, and there have been times when I'm almost asleep, and I remember, I didn't pray, and I'll roll out of bed, get out of the covers, and get on my knees and pray. That little difference has made for me. You know, it used to say in the beginning, humbly on our knees, ask God to remove these shortcomings, and then they changed it over during the arguments. But, you know, so that made a difference for me. And I found a God of my understanding. And maybe, aren't we close to Yosemite? We're closer than I am anyways. It's somewhere. And we're mountains. There's mountains. So some of y'all might have. I heard a story about a guy that was like me and didn't want anything to do with God. His sponsor told him, go up in the, go to Yosemite. Go to the mountains, Sierra Nevadas, wherever we are. Go up there. Black Mountain. Go up on Black Mountain. Thank goodness Brent was there to save it from the fire. Go up there. And, come on, that was good. That wasn't? I thought that was good. You ever seen his book? Go out there and find God. And so the newcomer did. He went out there and he was in the trails up in the middle of Yosemite and or Yellowstone, wherever it was, and he was just in touch with nature, and then he saw a bear looking at him, and he started running, you know, and he looked over his shoulder and the bear was running towards him, and he was getting scared, and he tripped over a stump on the ground, or a root in the ground, fell on the ground. The bear caught up to him, lifted his paw up, drooling his drool, and the guy on the ground, the newcomer with no God in his life, screamed, "Oh God!" And there was lightning in the sky, and the bear froze, and the sound and voice from the sky said, "Oh, you're in a little bit of trouble, and now you believe in me." And the newcomer says, "God?" He says, "Yeah, this is God." He says, "Wow, you're real." And he goes, and God, and the voice in the sky said, "Yes, I'm real." And he says, "Wow. So now you believe, huh?" And the newcomer thought, "Well, if I go back to those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, now, after I've been talking all this crap about no God and don't want to hear about God, they're going to make fun of me. They're going to laugh at me. They're going to ridicule me." He said, "How about you make the bear believe?" The voice from the sky said, "Okay, I'll make the bear believe." And lightning comes down, and the bear brings his paw down and says, "Thank you, God, for this food." And the guy got up and ran away. But he went back to meetings. And I guarantee you, my experience is not that anybody made fun of me and ridiculed me when I found a God of my understanding. Anybody working a program of Alcoholics Anonymous will be happy for you, will be cheering for you, whatever God you find. We don't care in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't. Those of us working a program, and it's qualified. I read an article in the Grapevine years and years ago about a woman on the East Coast, maybe from Worcester. Worcester, the third largest city in Massachusetts, by the way. I know that. It's also a pocketbook. It's not a purse, right? Anyways, this woman in the Grapevine meeting talked about that when she talked about her God, people at meetings laughed and snickered under their breath, and because when she talked about her God, she talked about female God. You know what? If you have a female God and she keeps you sober, keep her. And no one in Alcoholics Anonymous working a program, anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous working a program will cheer for you and be happy for you. We don't care. We just want you to stay sober. And if she keeps you sober, keep her. But there are not. Everybody in here is not healthy. Everybody in here is not working a program. Everybody not here for the right reasons. And I'm not going to define right reason. Not me to define. But there is a right reason and a wrong reason and all the others in between. And for me, my example, I told you I came here and I didn't want to hear anything about God. I fell to my knees, started praying. I started going to church. Became a Christian, you know. Went on a men's retreat up in the Santa Cruz Mountains and with my church, and you know, and things happened at 2 a.m. one night, and became a Christian. That was cool. Then one of my children is her major in college. Her secondary major was religion, so she knows a lot. And she was up in New York, and she invited me out to New York with her. That's when I went to the meetings of the Timers. But she invited me out to New York, and we went to upstate New York, and we went to this Buddhist monastery, and changed my life. Absolutely changed my life. It was about in 2003 or 4, maybe 2, right in that range. And what we did there, what they did in that monastery, two things happened. Is meditation. See, I'm at that time, what am I, 25 years sober, something like that, or I guess maybe 15, whatever it was, 15 years sober. And I had never meditated. You know, I didn't want to hear about it. I mean, no one knows I don't know how to meditate. I don't need to mention it to anybody that I don't know how to meditate. I'm not meditating. I'm praying. That's enough. Well, no, the thing says prayer and meditation. I don't know how to do it, though, and I don't know what to do, so I'm not going to try. And but then I went to this Buddhist monastery, and we went into meditation room, and they sat there for 30 minutes, and you meditated. I mean, there's no choice about it. I didn't do it wrong. There is no wrong way to meditate. I just sat there with the people that were doing it differently, and it all worked out. And then the moment that changed my life, though, was when we came out of one of those meditation meetings or meditation times, and it was time for to go across this field to the dining facility for food. And I fell in behind one of the Buddhist monks. And there were trails to walk on that were defined. You couldn't veer off the trails. And this Buddhist, I want to get over there and eat. I'm hungry. And this monk was doing what they call mindful walking, which is slow walking. And I'm like, come on. And it hit me. The God of my understanding hit me, and it said, dude, it doesn't matter, because when you get over there to the dining facility, we wait for everybody to get there, and we hold hands and pray. It didn't matter if I got there in 10 seconds or 3 minutes. It wouldn't matter because we wait for everybody to get there. And it slowed me down. And you know what's the effect? How does that apply now in LA traffic or in traffic? You know, the car that wants to get in front of me, that there's no space. There's space just enough for him or his car to get in there, but he thinks it's going to make a difference. I'll slow down and let him in or her. You know, where you stop, I'd speed up, make sure. No. And that kind of thing is what makes a difference. So the people going up the subway in New York right after all that happened, there's people racing up the subway, and I'm in no hurry, you know. Now, Teresa, I do drive fast at times, and I do want to get around that big truck before it's a solid yellow line, that kind of thing. But it really slowed me down. And then the other part of New York, and anybody that's been there, even if you haven't, you know about it, is they have these boroughs, these areas that are ethnic related, the different ones. And one of them was these Hasidic Jews. And these Hasidic Jews are extremely proud of their heritage. They walk with faith, and they do things by the book in the Jewish faith and the heritage. And I'm Jewish. Right? My grandparents lived the Jewish thing. My mom moved out to California and left it all behind. Just ditched it. But I have this Jewish thing in my background, and I go, I want to know more about my Jewish faith. I said to God in New York when I saw these Hasidic Jews, how proud they were of who they are. I want to know more about being Jewish. I'm in the airport leaving, and hopefully I can tell this without crying. I used to not be able to tell the story without crying. I'm in the airport leaving New York, and a young Hasidic Jew comes up to me, and he says, are you Jewish? Now, if he'd asked me the previous 50 years of my life, 45 years of my life, I would have said no. But because of what had happened to me in New York and up in the monastery, in the Buddhist monastery, I said, yes. And he said, we need you. And I'm like, what? And he said, yeah. And he brought me over. And in the Jewish faith, they have a thing called a minyan. And a minyan is 10 or more men praying together. And they had 9. I was their 10th. That is the God of my understanding. I have no idea what they said. They were praying in Hebrew. I was crying like a baby just to be part of it with them. I tell my God, I want to know more about my Jewish faith, and the next day he's got me in a minyan. Are you kidding me? That's the God of my understanding. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with no God. My neck hairs bristled, and now I consider myself a Christian Buddhist Jew. And that works in Alcoholics Anonymous, baby. That's right. That works in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then finally, the inventories. You know, as I mentioned, I've done more inventories in the last 6 years than any of the previous before. I did one. I'll tell a little bit about it, because it makes a difference to me. And let me tell the story before you take my inventory, okay? I had a meeting that it was a tag meeting, which means, I don't know, you guys have that up here? You know, a tag meeting? Okay. And one of these guys, old-timer guys, one of the old-timers in my neck of the woods, he got called on, he shared whatever he shared. And then he called on the pretty young thing at the end of the table, 22, 23, day one back from her relapse. And I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? And don't take my inventory. Let me finish the story, okay? Are you kidding me? If that had been a fat old man on his day one back on his relapse, would you call it? If that had been me day one back on my relapse, but since it's a pretty young girl, you know, I'm angry. That's resentment for those of you that are new. I'm resentful. I'm angry. All right, but let me finish the story. Another thing happened in that meeting. This young, older gentleman got called on, and I was his grand sponsor, if you will. I sponsored his sponsor. He said he got called on to share, and he shared something or other, and he said, you know, tomorrow I'll have 30 days. Now, I'm not looking for any applause or anything. And then he paused. And he looked around the room. And then that guy over here started clapping for him. And then everybody started clapping for him. And I'm like, no, not this guy. Not this. He was, first of all, he was smoking pot at the time. And, you know, within days, he was drunk again. And again, let me finish the story before you take my inventory, okay? Please, 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 please let me finish the story. Because what I did is I did inventory on those are resentments. I'm resentful at the group clapping for this guy because I know more about it, all right? I'm resentful at this old-timer calling the pretty girl at the end because I think it's he's got an ulterior motive, right? This is... So I put it on paper, and I realized, who the hell do you think you are? And I talked to myself in the third person. Who do you think you are deciding who gets clapped for in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous? You liked it when they applauded for you, and I was that guy. You know, I'm the guy who wants all the attention. I told you, I would tell you everything I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous to make sure you knew all the work I'm doing. Because I want credit for it back then. Now I don't care. But back then I did. Who are you to say who gets called? The only time I have anything to say on who gets called on in a meeting is if I'm the one leading it and I don't make it a tag meeting. I choose who I want to call on. That's it. Let go of it, dude. Who do you think you are? Is what I write to myself. And that's the kind of things that Cheryl, is Cheryl out yet? Purple Cheryl? No, there. That's the kind of Cheryl and my Gail. I hope Cheryl can do that for you folks, because that Gail that I mentioned, she could say those things to me. And sometimes they go in one ear and out the other, and sometimes they catch. And it's gotten to the point now where I think any man or any woman or any person, I've grown enough now that I would hear from you. Hear anybody tell me those things. But back in the day, I couldn't. And I could say it to myself. So I did that inventory. And then I went and did the fifth step with a friend of mine. And what I was told, I was thinking, yeah, I see what you mean, calling that newcomer. That's crap, man. That's you know, I see what you mean. But instead, what I got was, man, you seem to have a problem with the pretty people. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I'm like, yeah, the pretty people. These pretty people get called on, or this person over here. And I also, while I was doing inventory, one of the things I do while I'm doing inventories is I think about what else do I have resentment against while I'm at it. And one of them was this guy that was in really good shape. A guy like Jacob. Not, I don't have resentments against Jacob, but Jacob's in good shape, wherever Jacob is. You know? And I'm like, because I grow. But, like, you know, and I was getting fat or whatever, blah, blah. And so I put him on it, you know. I mean, I'm doing an inventory. I may as well do it on him. And so I have resentment against the pretty people. So that I'm like, what? So it's kind of like I got a resentment against the moon, and this person's telling me I got a resentment against the sun, that the sun is the issue. And I'm like, no, it's the moon. No, it's the sun. You got an issue with pretty people. I went, the next week I was talking in Mammoth, right? Mammoth Lake, right? Big, is that the one that was skiing and everything? You know, or Big Bear. It was Big Bear. What's the one out, anyway, out by Tehachapi, and then you go north, right? That one. Where, it doesn't matter. I was somewhere. Out of the middle of nowhere. And it was a long drive. And I could have gone out hiking and everything, but what I did instead is I stayed in the cabin that I was in, and I did an inventory on the pretty people. This is the next weekend. And it was an 11-page inventory on the pretty people. And it starts out with, I'm 30 years sober at the time, maybe it was 29 years, it's within the last couple of years. I've done hundreds, scores, if not hundreds of inventories. And it starts out with, it all started in fourth grade with John Corbin. He always got picked first in kickball. No, I'm not trying to be funny. I mean, I've done lots and lots and lots of inventories, but I hadn't done one on John Corbin getting picked first in kickball in fourth grade. And then it talked about people local guys, the hip-slicking cool people in my neck of the woods that are on so many of my inventories. It's getting crazy. These guys I'm jealous at because they, for whatever the reasons, until I put it on paper and figure it out. And then I get free of it, you know. And the reason I even share those stories is because I was down in... Oh, it doesn't even matter. Because that's my experience. And the last thing I'll say on that part is, you know, I used to... One of the things I do, if I'm upset, hurt, my feelings get hurt at a meeting, or if you anger me, or you don't like me anymore, or if I perceive you don't like me anymore, I will delete you from contact. I'll delete that person from contact. There's no way I ever got to make amends for that, because you don't know I did it, and it feels good. I'm going to delete. Oh, it feels good. Oh, try it. It feels good. You know, delete someone from contact. You know, I did something. And one time I came home and from a meeting, and someone had upset me on something or other, and I said to the woman I was at that time married to, and she said, I thought she'd say, you know, what's wrong, baby? What happened? Why are you upset with him? What'd he do? What she said is, you sure are deleting a lot of people from contact. And I went, wow. I had been. And so the next day, it was Memorial Day weekend, 4 years ago or so. And the reason I remember is because I did the inventory Saturday morning at my kitchen table on that guy. And while I was at it, I did it on 7 other people and a principal with which I was upset at the time. And I met Monday morning at my sponsor's house in the backyard. I had a local sponsor at the time for a moment. And met with him and did that inventory and got free of him, all of it. And my relationships have changed a lot because of the inventories I've done on people, the local people, the friendships I've made and garnered because of it, because I've done that work. And the last thing on the inventories, and I'll move on to service, and then I'll sit down. I have found that inventories out here, you guys, I'm sure you guys split wood. Hopefully, you know, with an axe and a maul. You remember that? For those of you, I'll explain it because it ties into the inventories for me. I'm not talking about a hydraulic splitter. That's cheating. I'm talking about you get the rounds of wood, and Brent remembers doing this when he was a kid. I doubt he's done it lately, but that's good. Come on, you guys, that was good. I thought it was good. round pieces of wood, and you get the maul and the axe, and you try to hit them in the middle and they split, hopefully. And if you haven't done it for a long time, it takes a lot of work before you finally hit it in the same spot twice, and then it does split. And when you get that round to split into halves, splitting them into quarters is a lot easier, right? Unless there's a knot in there. And then it takes a little bit more work to make it split or to make it work right. But eventually you get so good at it, you can get it with one hit or two hits. You get that axe where it needs to go, you put the maul in the cut you made, and you can hit that maul and split the, it gets good. You get good at it after you've done it for a while. Same exact thing for me with inventories. Exactly like that. Exactly. The hardest part is getting started. And when I get going on it, I'm not sure. I don't know. What's an inventory? I don't know. I'm gonna do the best I can. And it's gotten to the point now where I know what I'm writing about. In fact, I had done some stuff recently on I had done 3 inventories on the same topic, and I wasn't getting the results I was looking for. I knew there was a light. I knew there was happiness at the end of inventories. I knew there was figuring it out at the end of inventory. I had done an inventory 3 times on the same exact thing, person, and nothing came of it. It was on the 4th one. One more item came to mind, and I got free of it. 180 degree change. Because I know that there should be some. I get that feeling. I get that magic elixir, if you will, from those inventories. I've done them so many times. I know. And that's what they're like for me, you know, and they will be. I almost guarantee it for you if you just do them enough. For me, I don't criticize the guys I work with, people. I actually sponsor a couple of women as well. But I don't critique it, don't judge it, don't do anything to do with grammar or spelling. I don't care. It ain't about that. It's about getting to the underlying causes and conditions is what I've learned. And then the last thing I'll share about is service. You know, I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous to be a service. I didn't come here to pour your coffee. I didn't come here to pick up cigarette butts, put away chairs. You know, I came here to not drink. And as I mentioned, some of the things I do. And it became for me a family disease and family recovery. You know, my kids, they're all adults. My youngest is 30 now, but, you know, they all growing up, they you know, were part of Alcoholics Anonymous one way or another. One of my daughter Jessica, who's actually on the radio, she's a radio DJ on in a local sunny country. She's a country, likes country, and it doesn't even matter. She's on the radio, and she used to come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with me all the time. And I used to do this. I used to work out in the penitentiary in Lompoc, convict in the back, going, "Damn, I thought he looked familiar." Yeah. Anyway, but I used to work out in the penitentiary, and we used to bring in speakers all the time. We bring them on the first Saturday of the second Saturday of the month. We'd bring them in. No, first Saturday of the month, we'd bring them into the penitentiary. And, you know, the convicts had a joke: commit a crime, go to prison, have circuit speakers come visit you. It was kind of cute. But anyways, Jessica had, and then they'd speak that night at a big speaker meeting, like one like this, once a month. And Jessica, my daughter, had a commitment at that meeting to sell cassette tapes. That's how long ago this was. And ring the bell when it was time to come in from the break and all that stuff. And one night, Jessica got invited on the first Saturday of the month. She got invited to go to a sleepover. She's 11 years old. She's 31 now, so it was 20 years ago. She got invited to go on a sleepover with a couple other girlfriends and girls. And she came to me and said, "You know, Dad, what should I do?" And I said, "Honey, go. You go be with your girlfriends. It's fine. You know, someone else can count the money, sell the tapes, and ring the bell." And she said, "But Dad, I have a commitment. I had her sponsor me, man. I was like, God, are you kidding me? I was like, well, you know, that's what she's learned through me, through you, in Alcoholics Anonymous. So she, you know what she did? She came. She rang the bell, counted the seventh tradition that night, and we dropped her off at the slumber party, and she didn't miss it. They stayed up all night anyway. You know, another time she was in San Diego going to college, and she got on the train to come up to visit me, us up in Santa Maria, and across from her was a young lady about her age who had a softbound big book in her hand. So it was just a blue cover. You couldn't see Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, just, you know, like that. That's what this young lady is sitting across from her in the train. And my daughter Jessica, who's not one of us in that sense, she doesn't drink much. But she said, rarely have we seen a person fail who is thoroughly followed. And the young lady looked at her and said, oh, you're an alcoholic. And she said, no, but my dad is, and I know all about AA. And it turns out this other young lady was a newcomer on her way to visit family up in Oregon and was scared to death making this trip. And Jessica was with her for the next 5 hours on the train talking AA. You know, that's the alcoholic. You know, my son Jeremiah, there was a time when he was a kid, you know, he had a cough and he wouldn't take his cough medicine. You know, Robitussin back in the day used to come, it comes with a shot glass on the top of it now. You know, yeah, and he wouldn't take it. And finally, he took it. He took that little shot of Robitussin and swirled it around, held it up, and said, more. You know? So I brought my kids to meetings, you know, so they know where to go when they need to, you know. And the last two, I'll tell Emily, my daughter Emily, one time I was talking down in Thousand Oaks. Got down to Thousand Oaks and could not. And Emily, I took my kids with me most of the time. And Emily came with me that night. And she came with me that night. And we got there and I couldn't find it. The church, they moved. And see, it's kind of like if I'd have come here and been invited here before 5 years ago, whatever. And I know where it's at. So, yeah, we're good. But Bill didn't mention, no, we moved from the vets hall. Now we're down the hall. You know, kind of that's kind of what happened. I just said, yeah, I'll be there at a time when I need to be there. And we didn't coordinate because we knew I'd been there before. But it turns out they'd moved from one church to another and I didn't know about it. But I took Emily with me that night. And when I got there, couldn't find it. I go, well, they don't need me. You know, they can just get Teresa. They can get Brent. They can get, you know, Cheryl. They can get whomever they got. Or who's our circuit speaker? Peggy? Is it Peggy that's a circuit speaker? Jokingly, right? Anyways, they can get anybody in the audience to talk. They don't need me. And I got 2 hours of my daughter here, and I'm going to get 2 hours of my daughter back. Amen. Thank you, God. And then I said, well, let's go get some food. And so we went to this restaurant nearby. And back then I wore a tie that had a regular tie that had a circle and a triangle on it, you know, AA symbol. And I got there, and the hostess said, oh, are you speaking tonight? And I was like, well, I was, but I couldn't, you know. She said, no, they moved churches. And so we didn't eat. I went and did the deal. But that's the God of my understanding. And then the last thing, Palm Springs. One time, I used to not be able to tell this story without crying. I was in Palm Springs. That's a 6-hour drive from my house, 6.5 hours, maybe even more. And my daughter, Julianne, who's 30, so it was 17 years ago, because she was 16 at the time. She made that drive with me. You know, and 16-year-old daughters do not hang out with their dads, generally speaking. Unless what? Unless their dad was taught to be a father through Alcoholics Anonymous, through Keith Carpenters and Cliff Roaches and Brents and whomever you've got in this area. Those men who taught me how to be a dad. I didn't have a dad. Clint Eastwood, John Wayne. That's it. Tough, strong, don't show any emotion. That's me. Until I came in here and was taught how to be a father so that my 16-year-old daughter made that 6.5 hour, wanted to be with her dad on that 6.5 hour trip to hear him talk. She'd heard me lots and lots of times say the same damn thing. There's nothing new she hadn't heard, but she got to hang out with her dad. And the important part about why I bring the story up, not just that part of it, but when I was introduced the way Teresa did this morning, when that person introduced me up, she was sitting next to me and she kissed me on the cheek and said, good luck, Dad. I know, and I still had tear up inside. There were times where right now I was crying telling this story. And it didn't transpose out to you in the audience because you don't feel the emotions I'm feeling. But to have my daughter do that, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Make me be a dad that his children love him and be able to be those kind of things. It's amazing. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's absolutely the best thing that ever happened to me, man. Absolutely. You know, I get it. Kids being born is great, important, and all the kind of graduating, all those things are important. But without Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have him in my life. I wouldn't be the man that I am today. And the last thing I'll share is, you know, I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is like a huge swimming pool. If you picture a big, huge swimming pool of alcohol, an Olympic-sized swimming pool of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of us are in this pool of Alcoholics Anonymous swimming around doing our thing, and there are some people in this pool that swim really well. Really good. They put their head barely out of the water and they get to the end of the lane. They do a flip turn without even splashing. I mean, they just look good. And if you're like me, I want to swim like that guy right now. I want to swim like him right now. I don't want to do the work. I don't want to do anything. I want to pick up cigarette butts. I just want to swim like that. I want to be the main speaker at the second speaker meeting I ever went to. But they don't go, hey, you angry, pissed off guy, never worked stiff. You want to talk? No, they don't. That's not how you get up here behind. That's not how you get guys like Bill and Brent calling you. You know how you do it is by picking up cigarette butts even though you don't smoke. Staying after and putting away these chairs even though you don't feel like it. Going to detox on Wednesday night even though you'd rather stay at home and watch whatever's on TV. You know, whatever. That's how these little things where we change our courses just a little bit. That's what makes a difference for me anyway. And so there's people like that swimming in this pool of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's people that are treading water. And there's people doing the side stroke. And there's people holding on to the side. You know, just wanting, looking at the rest of us out there swimming and wanting to swim like that. And I tell you what, if you stay in the pool, we'll give you everything we got for free. For fun and for free. We'll give you everything we got to teach you to swim like we do. All right, for free. That one newcomer, Catholic Brian, taught me a stroke in Alcoholics Anonymous when he said to me, I had a God in my life looking out for me and I didn't even believe in him. Every one of us, whether you have more time than me or less time than me, whether we have more time than you or less time than you, we can help you if you want help. The key thing is you got to stay in the pool. We will never learn to swim by looking at a virtual program on the internet. Not going to happen. Reading about it in a book. Reading about swimming in a book. Here's how you swim. And then go jump in a pool. Not going to work. You know, it's going to be a problem. You can learn. You can know in your head about it. But until you get in here with us in the pool of Alcoholics Anonymous, you won't learn how to swim. It won't happen. So I appreciate you guys being here tonight, this morning. And I appreciate all your love and support. I hope I can give it, given some of it back to you. And I hope you all stay in the pool. Thank you very much. Wow.